talk about the Brothers K, but look at this poem quickly to kind of set up something. In attention to for the recording, my name is Paul Olson. I'm a teacher at Holden Village, and sometimes I teach at Augustana College in Rock Island, Illinois, where I also coach track and cross country and ride my bike. Just a reminder, if you weren't here on Saturday, the Brothers K is a nickname coming out of the Dostoevsky novel, The Brothers Karamazov, and I think that's borrowed from the profound theological discussions that occur in The Brothers Karamazov, especially in the chapter of the Grand Inquisitor. And I'll just remind you that K is also how a strikeout is recorded when we're playing baseball. And I thought if there were a theme today, it's the reminders K is a strikeout, and then but we still keep coming up to bat. Even after we strike out, we're going to come back and keep hoping for a hit. And we get singles and doubles and triples, and once in a while we hit home runs. And there's a great little quote somewhere in here. They're asking one of the great baseball players, what do you remember about that Grand Slam home run that won the World Series? And the guy says, well, I think the bases were loaded. That's all he said. Well, what are we thinking? And I'd like to take us through this. Remember I said that I think literature is not about something only. It is an experience in itself. And part of that just means I get to read to you and read to you from a wonderful writer. But first we'll look at this Mending Wall by Robert Frost. And the intention is, you could study this, we could spend the whole 45 minutes easily on this, but I want to do something else with it that pulls us into the Brothers K. By the way, Frost read this himself in Berlin when they built the wall. And then Kennedy referred to it too. And the first, they're not really stanzas here, but the first couple lines are just suggest, I'm just going to give you a summary of it and then just read straight through and then ask you what you think. This wall, put yourself as Frost was in New England, and you've got all these stone fences weaving their way throughout New England, separating farms and apples from pine cones and cows from sheep and so on. He questions that there's something about this. Why does it keep tumbling down? I've been picking rocks and with Ben's son, and we're just having a great time. And I keep thinking, you know, rocks are perennials. That's my final decision. They just keep coming back. What good are we doing here? So he wonders, you know, how do they, something doesn't love a wall. And what is it about them? And, maybe hunters make them. And he tries to find some kind of rationale for putting these walls back up and for having them. But ultimately, they're in line 10. It's a mystery. But we continue to repair these walls like we continue to pick rocks. But we repair it. In fact, we work really hard at it. Down there in line 16 and 17, we wear our fingers, I guess it's line 20, we wear our fingers rough with handling them. And this is hard work, and we're going to do it. But they don't really care so much with the line just above that. We use a spell to make them balance. Sometimes as they pile them up, it's hard to do that. And they say, stay where you are till our backs are turned. In other words, as soon as our backs are turned, I don't give a rip what happens to it. But they still have to do this. And so the purpose of it, he keeps wondering about this. And then he tries to find some kind of rationale. Well, we're separating apples from pine cones. And then in the second column there, where it says, I wonder. And he talks about cows and separating his herd from my herd and so on. And then finally, well, we just got to find some reason. And maybe it's just elves. But I would rather that my neighbor said that for himself. Okay, we'll go through it, and I'm just going to ask you at the end, what are your thoughts and feelings? And I'll remind you, at least my own literary axiom is, literary criticism starts in the guts, not in the brain. Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that sends the frozen groundswell under it and spills the upper boulders in the sun and makes gaps even two can pass abreast. The work of hunters is another thing. I have come after them and made repair where they have left not one stone on a stone, but they would have the rabbit out of hiding to please the yelping dogs. Now, the gaps I mean, no one has seen them made or heard them made, but at spring mending time, we find them there. I let my neighbor know beyond the hill, and on a day, we meet to walk the line and set the wall between us once again. There, it sounds like an English teacher for a second. There's iambic pentameter that is what they do, right? On a day, we meet to walk the line and set the wall between us, and I don't want you to throw up, so I won't read it that way. To each the boulders that have fallen to each. And some are loaves, and some so nearly balls, we have to use a spell to make them balance. Stay where you are until our backs are turned. We wear our fingers rough with handling them. Oh, just another kind of outdoor game, one on a side, it comes to little more. There where it is, we do not need the wall. He is all pine, and I am apple orchard. My apple trees will never get across and eat the cones under his pines, I tell him. He only says, good fences make good neighbors. Spring is the mischief in me. And I wonder if I could put a notion in his head. Why do they make good neighbors? Isn't it where there are cows? But here there are no cows. Before I built a wall, I'd ask to know what I was walling in or walling out and to whom I was like to give offense. Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that wants it down. I could say elves to him, but it's not elves exactly, and I'd rather he said it for himself. I see him there bringing a stone grasped firmly by the top in each hand, like an old stone savage armed. He moves in darkness, as it seems to me, not of woods only in the shade of trees. He will not go behind his father's saying, and he likes having thought of it so well, he says again, good fences make good neighbors. Any thoughts? It's not a quiz.
I'm thinking of the Butter Battle book when they're building a wall between the two nations.
The what?
Butter Battle book, Dr. Seuss, and they're building this wall.
Okay, that's a little bit above my literary stance here.
It's an arms race. Yeah.
Butter side up or butter side down?
Yeah. Okay, yeah, good. And I do know that. So they're congenial about this? What does the speaker think of his neighbor?
A savage.
Huh?
A savage.
Yeah, they won't even call him that, like some stone savage. I mean, what's this? Is this a crazy custom and we're doing this? And obviously it's no purpose. There are no cows to separate his herd from mine. My apples aren't going to eat his pine cones. But he says good fencers make good neighbors.
He moves in darkness.
And it's a metaphor, isn't it? You just don't do this at night.
I mean, I see it as he's thinking of his neighbor as being in the dark.
Yes.
About this.
Yeah.
And he has a...
Yeah.
Enlightened idea.
He's the enlightened one, isn't he?
The neighbor's doing what his father did before.
And so here I've written up this, what are we thinking? And there's this institution out there, and institutions can be structural institutions, but also can be just traditions and customs that become institutionalized. Go ahead.
What else are they going to do with the rocks? They're spilling to the sun because every winter the rocks are pushed up and they have to do something with them.
Yeah.
What are his other options besides his wall?
Why do they have
to? Or to leave him lie.
Yeah, why do they have to do something?
Traditionally, you'd be farming.
Bingo.
Them out.
Tradition.
Traditionally. But he kind of dispels that notion, right? You're right. And that's exactly what they're thinking. We have to do something here. It's like, what was your joke yesterday in the Sunday school kids, it makes all the noise in there, and the teacher opens the door. Stop us, we're being bad, and we don't know how to stop.
Right.
I love this story, and I'll remember it forever, and I'll use it in teaching every day, and I'll footnote Ben Stewart, who said, good.
Well, I don't know if I wouldn't say enlightened, but he's wanting to ask the questions. I love that line, before I built a wall,
yeah.
I asked to know
yeah.
what I was walling in or walling out. So he wants to go deeper. It's not like he was not ever going to build a wall. But
yeah.
Why?
Good. He wants to. And he, we can call him enlightened. He at least wonders. Let's at least ask the question. You're into the power of this poem, but I'm going to turn it on its head in 2 seconds.
I was thinking of a story. I don't remember where I heard it, but the first time it was going to be Thanksgiving at the daughter's house, and she got ready to to, or it was a, I guess maybe it was, whatever, it was a big, big standing rib roast, and she cut it in half and
yeah.
put it in two pots, and then and said, why'd you cut it in half? I don't know, Mom always did. And when her mom got there, she said, well, why'd you cut the roast? Why'd you always cut the roast in half? She never had a pot big enough.
The pan,
you know,
yeah.
You know? Yeah,
yeah,
didn't have a pan. You know, so
but she did it, and she had a big enough pan.
That's how you always
yeah.
did it. You know, it's sort of sometimes things you just do because it's how it was always done.
Yeah, what are we thinking? And I'm just going to put that down there. Are we thinking? Ben, you did...
Well, this, I was kind of along the same lines as Linda there, this image of... before I built that wall, I'd want to know. And it, to me, I was going there. That contrast with the old stone savage arm... just our kind of hyper building and manipulation of Earth's environment right now, in this sense of we aren't reflectively asking the question, what are we walling in, what are we walling out with all our new technologies and our new building and resource depletion? Like, what, there isn't this time to pause. And
yeah.
the scene of this poem, of like the old stone walls in New England and across Europe, has this ancient sensibility about them, and yet we're kind of in a wall building frenzy right now.
We're being bad and don't know how to stop.
Well, I have a funny context too, though. What about firewalls that we do internet-wise? And what we spend so much time and energy trying to keep others out of our privacy settings, and that's a whole different tangent you can go
on. Well, it is. I'm still trying to get online here. I don't know.
See, the firewall is very effective. We're not sure why you can't get online.
It's not a firewall. It's a wall up here somewhere. Well, we want to get into Brothers K, and I'll stay after our 4:45 or 5:45 time to talk about this as much as you want. But think about this. Who initiates the building?
He does.
And what do you think about that?
Because he says, I let my neighbor know beyond the hill and on a daily need to walk the line.
So one guy never even asked the question. He's got this mantra, good fences make good neighbors, and that's why I do this. I don't understand that. He doesn't. But the other guy knows it. I wonder, what are we walling in? What are we walling out? But by the way, let's do it. We're being bad and don't know how to stop.
Yeah. Even though it's kind of, he references the boulders and this unnaturalness of, he compares them to loaves, something you, if you were communing with your neighbor, versus these balls, you have to sort of keep in balance somehow. So either way,
and that's a, yep, thank you. It's a great reading of it. There is some kind of communion here between the neighbor, and maybe that's why he does it. I wrote at the end of it, as I read this again today, I thought of, if anybody's ever seen this, it's on a documentary there's a 13-1-hour series called Eyes on the Prize. It's very famous, and it's the civil rights movement of the 60s and 70s. And in that, in one of those, there's a beautiful interview that speaks to the beginning of this class now. Rosa Parks is being interviewed. She's sitting not in the jail cell, but out in the hallway, being interviewed by a reporter. And this is what she says. He came up to me and said, ma'am, and ma'am in itself is a good thing in the South. There should have been a racial slur, but he didn't do that. He was polite. Ma'am, you have to give up your seat. And I said, Rosa Parks is talking, and I said to him, I don't think I should have to. And why do you treat us so mean? And he said, I don't know, but the law is the law. David James Duncan, takes after institutions that are not only family institutions and traditions to cut the roast in half, or to be sure to have turkey and not roast beef. I was shocked that anybody would have roast beef. But there's also traditional thinking or non-thinking, and the guy says it all, I don't know, but the law is the law. And in the Brothers K, we're going to look at how some of the laws grow in these kids' minds, religious laws that they begin to question, and how they handle those. And so I get to read to you first some things that are just kind of to get us back in the mood of laughing, but how you'll get it in the connections here. There's a baseball game on, and Cade walks in, and Roger Maris takes the ball, then a strike. His hair's so short, the sides of his head looks like wads of chicken meat, and there's dark bags under his eyes, and he's incredibly sweaty and nervous looking. I usually like watching home runs, but there's something about Roger Maris that makes even his homers boring. I don't hate the Yankees like most people, so it's not that. I just don't care to watch Roger Maris. Everett feels the same way, only worse. Everett says he's from Mars, which is why he's named Maris. So maybe it's a racial thing. Whatever it is, it worries me a little because one of the things Jesus used to say was to love, and here's institutional thinking, and okay, it was to say to love everybody the same, whether they're geeks, yanks, wops, mix, merit of the stars, she's a gal in the church who lisps, or what have you. And when I look at Roger Maris, I'm not sure I'll ever be able to pull it off. Peter says there was once this Italian saint called San Francisco, the same guy they eventually named the Giants after, who loved Jesus a ton and was a truly wonderful person except for one small thing. He couldn't stand lepers. And I guess they were coming out of the woodwork there in Italy in his day. But one night in a dream, Pete says, who should come walking up to San Francisco but Jesus himself? And what does Christ do but order poor San to go out and kiss the first leper he sees? Pete says San Francisco woke up, quaking in his boots or sandals or whatever. And of course, no sooner does he step out the door than the skankiest looking leper ever invented comes dribbling right toward him down the road. For a minute there, Pete says, poor San can't figure out whether to shit or eat a donut. But he loves Jesus so much that he somehow staggers up to the leper, puckers his lips, shuts his eyes, and manages to get the job done. Except, here's the great part, Pete says, right while they're smooching, San peeks and sees that this walking ooze ball was actually Jesus all along. This was the big breakthrough the saint needed, apparently, since afterwards, Peter says, he went out and converted all the Italians and fish and wolves and sparrows to Catholicism and eventually got himself crucified on a miraculous cross up in the mountains that wasn't even there, really. Anyhow, Peter says, the thing is, everybody on earth must eventually face up to their own personal leper.
Ooh.
So these kids are thinking, and they're thinking through, are we thinking at all? They are, and it gets them in all kinds of trouble. One more to set up the stage for this is Mama has just made a pie, and I think the main theme that runs through this book is the transformation in people that leads to redemption. And what are the redeeming powers that have to go against all of this institutional thinking that controls our minds? Well, Mama, and here's, you'll get it. Mama has made a blueberry pie, and the kids are slobs. Remember, Freddie and Bette are the two twins, and they're little kids. They're like 6 and 7 years old, and the other guys are teenagers. I'll remind you that Irwin is in this scene, and he is strong and athletic and smart, and he's a tremendous athlete, and he can do anything. Well, they're eating these. Irwin just took a bite of the pie, and he ate the whole thing, and he ate the whole pie with a time it took me to eat 3 bites. And then Freddie says, "We helped!" Freddie brags, swinging on Irwin's knee. "Yeah!" hollers Bet. "We helped a lot! Mama said, 'You helped?'" Irwin snarls in a big, mean voice. They love big, mean voices. "How could you help? Are you lawyers or what?" They don't know what he's talking about, but grin at him anyway. Then he grabs them by the backs of their homemade overalls and hoists them up, one in each hand, clear up in front of his face. "How did you help?" he repeats. "I want to know." "They helped with the pie," Mama says. "Now put them down." Irwin pretends to start to drop them, then gets a gasp out of Mama, then jerks them back up in his face. "Do you little hemorrhoids expect me to believe you had anything to do with that delicious pie? Ha! Do you hear me? Ha!" Dangling high over the lethal concrete, the twins cover their mouths with fat purple fingers, then emit polite little tea parlor titters. "So tell me what really happened," Irwin says. "You just got in her way all day, didn't you? You just went bummo in your pants and whined, 'Mommy, I wanted this, Mommy, I wanted that,' all day, didn't you? Didn't you?" "We pin-rolled the dough," squeaks Freddie. "And now we want an airplane," bellows Met, and he's apparently done this before. He grabs them and he turns them around. They know what it means. "There will be no airplaning," Mama says. But the twins look great, hanging just alike in the sun there, arms out like wings, brown hair and skinny legs dangling. "Contact!" shouts Freddie. No contact, Mama shouts. But Mama honey, Irwin says in a thick southern drawl. They pinrolled the dough. You know what the good book says. None of your darned Bible games now. Games. Irwin lowers the girls, letting them hang at his knees like a couple of buckets. He looks incredulous. He looks perfectly serious. And you call yourself a believer? Do I have to spell it out? Have you backslid that far? Very well, then. Deuteronomy 3:16. And they who pinroll the dough shall be airplaned. Verily, unto illness shall they be flown about the yard. Unto air sickness, yea, and unto every other type of disaster shall they be propelled. And their poor mama shall watch, though it cleaveth her heart in twain to do so. Cade says, Irwin's getting awfully good at fake Bible jokes. He's picked it up from Everett, who rattles them off so smoothly you'd swear he was giving you the straight Moses till you stop to think about what he said. Mama's face is a wrestling match, scowl versus smile. But the twins are still dangling, and mothers do hate danger. Scowl wins. That's enough of your nonsense, she snaps. It's not my nonsense, Irwin says solemnly. It's the Lord's. The girls make the sounds of twin engines starting. He swings them up to shoulder height again. Mama gets truly mad. You think you're so cute, but what if those the coverall buttons snaps off? This, I holler. Kate is watching all this. This, I holler. And I flop back on the steps, writhe like my spine is crushed, roll my eyes up under the open lids, and send a big purple pie glob sliding out the side of my mouth. Irwin howls, Mama about barfs. The twins barely notice. They eat this way all the time. They pinrolled the dough, Mama, Irwin yells over their engine noises. It's God's law. It's out of my hands. And he lets out a gasp as the twins seem to leave his grip and plunge toward the concrete. Bet shrieks. Freddie whoops. Mama's hand fly to the top of her head, and I choke, though only from laughing. Because if there are any two things I trust in this family, it's Mama's button sewing and Irwin's muscles. So you get it. How are these kids forming their context for family love? And the last one that's one of my favorites. Brother Beale has stuck me in the corner again. I've told you that the kids have to memorize Bible verses, and if they don't, they have to sit in the corner. Brother Beale has stuck me in the corner again. What happens in the corner is you sit facing the wall with a Bible in your lap till you've memorized this week's memory verse. What Brother Beale hasn't yet figured out is that I don't learn my memory verses on purpose. I like it in the corner. There are six of us here this morning. Did I read this yesterday?
No.
I don't think so. Which is about average, unless it's some verse such as "Show me a penny" or "Jesus wept." Beale's helper, Sister Durrell, had to scour the whole basement to come up with enough Bibles for us. Then, when she was passing them out, she smiled and gave the only illustrated one to me. I about died. Sister Durrell is so beautiful compared to everything else at Sabbath school. It's like my eyeballs turn into compass needles and she's north. One time up in church, I stared at her so long that Everett got embarrassed and gouged me in the ribs, telling me to knock it off. But I gouged him right back and said, "Why should I?" He gouged me again and whispered, "Because Sister Durrell is at least 8 years older than you and engaged to Brother Beale, and if she was your age, she wouldn't have breasts, and her thick brown hair would be in scraggy pigtails, and she'd be as knobbly neat and snot-nosed as every other girl you know." I'll admit I hadn't thought of that. But I gouged him right back again and said that if she was my age, I'd ask her to marry me anyhow. I'd just set the wedding date for the age she is now. Well, they grow through all this wonderful communication and sense of devotion to each other. I'm skipping up into this now, where one of the epigraphs at the beginning of the chapter is a quote from the Brothers Karamazov. And Ivan, who was an atheist in the Brothers Karamazov, says to his little brother, who was an Orthodox priest, and who is a believer, not just an institutional follower. He's a believer. It's in his bone marrow. And Ivan says, "It may be different for other people, but we in our green youth have to settle the eternal questions first." And Everett, these kids, they're all searching. Peter tries Eastern religions, and he gets this. He's a brilliant guy, and he's also a great athlete, and he gets a scholarship to Harvard, and he studies, and he gets doctorals and postdocs and all kinds of things to somehow come up with something that will give him some sense of this, what they all kind of think are exploring is an absurd universe. Everett, he's a cynic. He's so ultra confident in his rejection of everything that he can, when the war comes, the Vietnam War, he goes to Canada. I'm so certain I'm right, and that he, that's how he grabs his own reality. My right, my view is right, and that's the way it is. And Irwin, I wrote it this way in my notes today. Irwin follows Christ, but the world won't let him. Mm. And so I will get into that now. About these are some of the eternal questions, and here's how Everett, who's kind of a snot-nosed kid, has just had an argument with Irwin. And they're talking about a woman who just kind of went crazy, and her baby was crying, and she threw it on the floor and stomped it to death. And Irwin says, it'll work out, because of the fight between Irwin and Everett. He said, that'll work out, and I don't mind. I mind, Everett said flatly. It won't work out, not between me and not between Mama and not between you and me. Sure it will. Everything always works out. The hell it does, Everett growled. And hearing his tone, I wanted to warn Irwin to concede the point. But he just let out a yawn and said, sooner or later, everything comes out in the wash, just like the good Lord intended. That's what I believe. Then explain concentration camps to me, Mr. Sunshine. Explain 6 million dead Jews or even Grandma's dead family. Explain that woman up in the Tri-Cities last week who didn't like the sound of her baby crying, so she threw it down on the kitchen floor and stomped it to death. How did that come out in the wash, Winnie? Winnie the Pooh? And if you say the baby went to heaven, buddy, I'll bust you, because what about the mother? What sort of wash is that crazy bitch going to come out in? And if you say hell, I'll hit you again, because how did she get so screwed up in the first place? What sort of life, what sort of a world turned her into a monster in the first place? Huh? If you ask me, people sin because they want to, not because Satan makes them. God either, this is right out of the Paradise Lost, for those of you who have ever heard of that or read it. God either made everything there is, Satan included, or he didn't make anything because he isn't there. He either knows everything or he's nothing. He's in charge of all of it or none of it. So what I was thinking about prayer, especially ours lately, was that when people turn it into begging, when they use it to try to blackmail God into giving them nothing but miracles and money and new cars and babies and marriages and all that, what they're really asking him is to remake or even unmake what he's already made. They're asking him to eat his words, his inventions, his art, his creation, all of it. If God is God, the only sort of prayer that seems to make any sense to me might go something like, hello there, God. I know thy will is being done today, as usual, and I think that's terrific, as usual. Of course, to me, your will looks like a crazy mess that's getting the richer, and the poor, poorer, and the innocent killed, and babies stomped and starved, and the whole world in danger of being blown up any minute by atom bombs and all. But you know all about me thinking that since you made me. So, sorry. And please, go right ahead, and do your will no matter what I think, even if it kills us. Talk to you tomorrow, Lord. Love, Everett. You can't do that. If you're a Seventh-day Adventist, you can't do that when you give the grace, and you heard that yesterday. Well, the kids, the little kids, began to pick up on some of this too. And now, by now, I'm halfway through the book, Peter is off and he's taken on all of these Eastern religions, and he's shown some of them to his little sister, who is now, must be about 10. And the wife of the minister at the church, it reads like this. Mrs. Babcock had been endearing to instruct her early teens, the kids out there, on the very real danger of cults and false religions. But when Mrs. Babcock tried to add a spice to her lecture about cults by adding that certain ex-members of this very church have fallen under Satan's power, referring to Peter, when she winced piously at a poster of a big brown-haired, idiotically grinning Caucasian football player-type guy who was supposed to be Jesus, then betrayed her own husband's confidences by looking straight at Winnie, the twin, and huffing. Some members of this very class have fallen under the influence of certain lost souls who have given their lives over to false Christs and satanic cults, while Freddie's radiator blew. For a while, no one knew it had blown, because Mrs. Babcock had said, "Let us close our lesson with a few heartfelt moments of prayer." But these heartfelt moments usually begin with a brief silence, followed by an extemporaneous chat between Mrs. Babcock and the Lord, during which the former did all the latter's thinking and talking for him. On this day, however, the silence was pierced by a high, quavering, angry voice singing, "Bismillahi Ramahamahani Rahaim." With great reluctance, Mrs. Babcock later admitted to Mama, Bet and the elder that the voice had been Freddie's. The reason for her reluctance was that the instant she heard it, she gestured for silence and said, "Children, the Holy Spirit, our Winifred is in return to us and she is speaking in tongues." At which point the singing stopped and Freddie laughed and said, "I am not, and I was singing in the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful." Too flustered to be angry, Mrs. Babcock said, "It sounded very pretty." "Thank you. It's Arabic. My brother Peter taught it to me, but Muhammad sang it first, and he got it straight from God." And before Mrs. B could recover, Freddie turned to the other kids and continued, "Muhammad was the Christ of the Muslims, and he was wonderful. He liked to ride camels and eat dates off palm trees and to make jokes, even at church. And when he'd bow down to pray, he had this little granddaughter he let ride on his back." When some of the kids appeared to enjoy this information, Mrs. Babcock gathered enough of herself together to shout that there would be no more talk of antichrists in her church. Both parties agreed that Freddie then shouted back, "Muhammad's no antichrist, and this isn't your church." But there was vehement disagreement on whether or not she added, "You big shit." Well, Mrs. Babcock is, like the thinker, I don't know what the law is, the law, is denouncing all other ideologies and not letting kids ask any kind of questions. And we next hear, how did Peter get that way? What made him search as he has? And I can read through this scene. Peter's a senior in high school. He's brilliant. He's thinking. He's asking all kinds of questions. And every time I read this, I think of it. I grew up in central Minnesota in the early 50s, and in the days of, you know, the Cold War was on full-fledged, and in this little town, every night some man volunteered to sit on top of the schoolhouse and with binoculars and watch for planes coming down, because if they're coming from Russia, they're going to come down through Alaska and over Canada. And that was our mentality. And we got the tremendous lessons to how to protect ourselves from the atom bomb, hide under the desk. And, that would work. Well, on August 6, 1945, Edward Conzi, arguably the greatest Buddhist scholar of this century, was riding in a train through England when he opened his morning paper and read of Hiroshima and of the world's first nuclear attack. He later wrote, "I have a very deep stomach and normally cannot be sick. But on this occasion, I vomited straight out the window." This was prophetic insight, for at that moment, human history had lost its meaning. Two decades later, an artistic filmmaker put together a film about the dropping of a bomb. The Pentagon's halt, and the Pentagon made this, and now this is institutional. And I guess the question I would ask us is, this is the military-industrial complex, and today it's become the food-industrial complex that it just controls us. And we continue to live without thinking much about it, or not fighting hard enough, I guess. They built this little house, and then they filmed it when the test bomb dropped on the house, and then they had kids watch this, and Peter's in the class. The Pentagon's house turned out to be a forlorn and lost-looking little abode, and Peter's thinking, "But in my father's house, there are many mansions." And these kids, no matter how agnostic, how many questions they ask, they continue to search for how to connect their own Christianity, and not the ridiculous one that's represented by Mama, but to question that and find out the real Christ. And they work at it, and so now he's looking at this, but in my father's house are many mansions, Peter thought as he watched. And no one could fault the Pentagon's technicians throughout thoroughness in stocking this one. They carted in fresh and refrigerated foods, a pantry full of canned goods, a freezer full of meats and vegetables. "I go to prepare a place for you," Peter thought. They hung never-to-be-worn jackets and hats on an oak coat stand in the front hall, and they put dummies in there, and I'm skipping through there. The army really had constructed four lifelike, white-skinned, 100% patriotic dummies, a daddy, a mommy, a little boy, and a little girl. The Last Supper, one of Peter's pals cracked as the camera finally drew away, but no one laughed. With the hushed excitement of a TV golf announcer, the narrator explained that a nearly indestructible movie camera had been mounted in a bomb shelter 2 miles from the house. And with that, the camera zoomed in on the four happy life... I better not skip this part. Aimed right at the plate glass window, and that by using glare-resistant filters and infrared film, they planned on getting accurate slow-motion footage of everything that went on in the dummy family's dining room during and after the blast. With that, the camera zoomed in on the four happy, lifeless faces, and the narrator counted down, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. But at zero, nothing happened. Seconds passed. The house remained standing. The dummies kept smiling. "Gee, Wally, that wasn't so bad," said the boy who made the Last Supper crack. All these kids are sitting in there watching this. And there were a few snickers. "Better light another one," someone said, and half the class began to laugh. Then the family simply vanished. It was not at all dramatic. The little lost house and everything in it disappeared in a flash of such pure and silent whiteness that Peter thought the film had broken. But then they began to perceive movement within the whiteness. No one, least of all the Pentagon narrator, could describe what they were seeing. But there was clearly a billowing, an erupting, a majestic swirling of heat and light pouring toward them and through them and far, far beyond them. It was mesmerizing. It was even beautiful. And it went on for a long time. Finally, the screen darkened. There was a stasis, and the modern problem student sighed, thinking the dummy family, though deceased, was at least at rest. But they were wrong. The billowing not only resumed, it reversed direction. The first wind, Peter realized, had been the explosion. "I go to prepare a place for you." Everything blown effortlessly aside as when a boulder lands in the pool and crushes the water away in all directions. But the second wind, the reversed wind, was the implosion. "And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you unto myself." The melted molecules of brick and insect and appliance and desert all rushing like water back into place after the throne boulder, the thrown boulder has sunk. And while the explosion's swirling whiteness had been photogenic, the implosion grew steadily darker and muddier looking, and it went on and on and on and on till even the Pentagon filmmakers grew bored. But here too, a full day later, there was a little to see or say. There was little to see or say. Which plume of smoke, which fleck of hot ash, which pile of raped molecules had been cockroach or coat rack, or synthetic boy or girl, could not even be asked, because these things hadn't just been destroyed. They'd been uncreated. A piece of planet had been splashed away like liquid, but what returned was not the rubble of what had departed. It was a no place, an unplace, a seething gray nada, where even the phrase ashes to ashes, dust to dust had no meaning. For this dust had been removed from any cyclic process. This ash would kill you if you touched it. This was deader than death. "Good flick," one boy cracked as the film ended. Then the lights came on, and Peter's buddies were dumbfounded to see their cool, collected, 500-hitting compadre sitting there committing the ultimate faux pas for an aspiring macho man. He was weeping. Pete and a couple of girls. He made no sound, but the tears were just streaming down his cheeks. He left the room. He couldn't stop crying and had no idea where he was going. He wasn't thinking that history or life or school had lost their meaning. He wasn't even thinking thoughts like Russia is real or hate is real or the dummy family is my family. It was worse than that. He wasn't able to use his mind at all. His strong, clear thinking had simply imploded, leaving him groping down a hallway in sheer mindless panic like a fly trapped in a jar. And when he came to the plate glass window at the end of the hall, when he pressed his face against it and began groping for a catch, lock, or lever, his blind hands discovered that in public high schools, the windows don't open, and he had no place to vomit. These are the kinds of religious and institutional questions that the kids ask again and again and again. And it's how Peter got to where he got when he's looking at the Eastern religions to somehow, how do we explain this crazy, crazy world? And I've written in my own notes, well, what led Peter there? And it's this and what Eisenhower talked to us about, right? The military-industrial complex, which today has turned into the, has added onto it, the food industry complex. And it takes Irwin, how does he get there too? In lack of questioning, and I put it this way, Irwin tries to live the life of Christ, but the world won't let him. And I think I can do this in 5 minutes. I'll stop no matter what. Irwin, I told you yesterday, gets drafted, and he tried to get conscientious objector status, but he couldn't get it because his girlfriend was pregnant. I mean, this guy is, well, you'll get it. He writes a letter home from Vietnam, and because of his great athletic skills, he takes target practice the first day. They realize how good he is. He becomes a sniper, and he writes to Cade, and I better set up three things. Some of you won't know. Victor is the enemy. VC is the enemy. Gook is the enemy. And Sparkle is a dog that Victor, at one time when he was living in Camas, Washington, in the Washuga River, there was a flood, and he jumped in the river to save the dog's life. And at great risk to his own life, but he knew what he was doing, and he did save it. You know how the rain zuzzes when it hits the water? That soothing sound the surface makes? Well, that's what I was hearing, just that zuzz in this letter from Irwin in the Mekong Delta. And the dripping of leaves and trees when it happened, but you wouldn't believe, Cade, how little things like that, things like rain falling into the Mekong, the same calm way it falls into the rivers back home, can stop your heart here. Because this river, remember, is warm as piss, and the air always smells wrong, and the trees and vines feel like they're watching and hating you and ready to kill you, and that's tiring, understand? But with my poncho, see, I could block all that wrongness out and frame in this perfect little zuzzing piece of river surface. As soon as I did, it slid me right on down by the Columbia, in late fall, maybe all brown and wide and floody, so that my one plan in all of life was to sit there as forever as possible. Remember, this is the guy who thinks all things will work out. And that's when it happens. And here is the institutional power coming in, the other soldiers who haven't got any sense of other than this is my duty and I will obey. And that's when it happens. That's when our point, Ducky Gelman, comes slithering through the brush, grabs Sergeant Felker, eases him all hush-hush down beside me, parts the vines, scopes in a tree just downriver, and by God, there he is, Victor. I see him bare-eyed myself, all in black, all alone, hunched in plain sight in this big green tree overhanging the water. Of course, without even thinking, we feel it's a trap. You always feel this, even when it can't be, since in the long run, everything about being here is a trap. Anyhow, Gelman's a big duck hunter back in real life and always has these duck hunting strategies he applies to the situation. So what he more or less says is that the Kong in the tree is a decoy and that 1,000 or so VC with 12 gauges are out there in duck blinds praying to the Gook God for us to shoot him and give our position away. Well, Felker thinks this over. I scope Victor in. I can see him perfect. He's only 150 yards off. I see the rifle in his lap, the radio on the limb behind him, the Chinese lettering on his rubber slipper soles. I even see his jaw working and for a second think he's singing. Then his hand goes to his mouth and I realize it's food. It's eating. He's just staring at the water, eating his damn Vietnamese lunch up there. So let's go, is my feeling. Leave him his lunch and let's scram. Then Felker whispers, he's no decoy, he's recon, same as us, watching for things moving up or down the river. And with that he turns to me, Christ, life is hard to predict, Cade. I didn't used to worry about it. God provides, I thought, so try your best and don't worry. So I never worried, back in boot, how high scores and target shooting would translate to a place like Nam. I just didn't see the day coming when some big scary mother like Felker would whisper like he was doing me some huge favor. Okay, Chance. Pop him good and let's scratch gravel. He can't be as loathsome as he looks. Cade, it scared me clean out of remembering who I am or was. Just do it and run, I tell myself. You didn't make the world, I tell myself. Left shoulder blade, Felker whispers, and I think, don't shake or he'll suffer. Think, sorry, Victor, but your time is up. Think, Jesus, forgive me. This guy believes in thou shalt not kill in his bone marrow. Jesus, forgive me. If you can believe that, then I start squeezing. The gun is very quiet in the rain. It sounds like a toy. But the guy in the tree, our nation's enemy, Victor, flips around sideways, crashes down through the branches, and ends up on his back on a wide leafy limb. His rifle splashes into the river. So does whatever he was eating. Gelman and Felker disappear, which is what I should do too, of course, but I just stand there. I never shot even an animal before. So it interests me. It interests me especially since he was just sitting there, same as me, and could have seen and shot me first. Or we could have gone happily on, not seeing each other, not shooting each other, enjoying the same zuzz as forever as possible. And then I noticed something else interesting. He isn't dead. He's hanging on to a limb with one hand, has a leg hooked over another, and neither the hand or the leg are letting go. I see blood all over his chest, though the bullet entered his back, so I know it's torn clear through him. The blood's running wet and black out of him, down through the leaves, dripping off his calves and feet, off his hair, off his elbows. He can't lift himself. He has no idea where the shot came from. He's not a VC anymore, not a commie anymore, not a dink, not a threat, not an enemy. He's just this ruined little person whose body doesn't want to die any more than mine does, and he won't let go. From the bushes somewhere, Felker tells me, "Come the fuck on, his friends are probably coming. He's still alive," I tell him. "Well, then deal with it and come," he says. And I hear them moving out, and I know I can't find my way through 10 yards worth of this jungle alone. So can you believe it? I do what he says. I deal with it. But I'm sick and shaking this time. I don't know where I hit him. And when he falls another few feet and lands on another big limb, he holds on to this one too. But he still keeps on landing on things, clutching at things, grabbing things. He's on the last limb above the river now. Blood all down through the tree, and the limb is sinking. The current's pulling him hard. His fist is slipping down a thorn vine that must be ripping his palm to shreds. And all this time I'm scoping him, hating him, waiting for some good part of him to show so I can squeeze around into it too. But then the current spins him and all I see is mouth, and it's wide open, Cade, gasping for air and full of unharmed teeth and a small pink tongue with unchewed bits of lunch still on it. And after all I've done to him, when I see this, I can't do more, so I just watch. I watch his first run out of vine, watch the limb flinging blood sway back up into the tree, watch to see what he does with nothing but water and air to clutch at. But when the current takes him and his head spins under, leaving nothing but that quiet zuzz, something in me spins under too. And I think, sparkle. Because remember that time? That little dog out of the Washougal? Because how in Christ's name, Cade, even as a soldier, can I not do for a man what I once did for a damn dog? So I drop my weapon. I drop it and start running to save the same guy I've just killed. And for 10 or 12 seconds, it's the most wonderful feeling. For 10 or 12 seconds, I'm me again, Cade, tearing along like it's football during the first clear and good and 110% right thing I've done since joining this fucking army. But I don't make it 60 yards before I hit jungle thicker than our laurel. So I just hang there. I just hang in the water there, watching him drift and drift, blind now. I realize, since with one hand he's still clutching at a shoreline an easy quarter mile away. And he never did drown, Cade. He never did quit clutching. And the Mekong is huge. It took him forever to disappear. It took him so long that by the time he was gone, everything had changed. And I'll read these last about 10 lines. In the context of the religious education he's had, how does he possibly figure this out? I didn't hurt anymore. Didn't feel like hiding anymore. Wasn't scared anymore because I wasn't anything anymore. Not anything I love or know or care about. Because thou shalt not kill, Cade. Thou shalt not kill. With all my heart I believe this, and I kill. So what am I now? And why should I live? How am I even alive? Because this is what our lives are. If doing this to others before they do it to us is all our lives are, we're already dead. Honest to God, I feel it, Cade. I'm dead. The hell with me. But don't be a fool. Don't blame Felker. He risked the shit out of his life for me. Gelman says he's even trying to wangle me a transfer to a place besides a brig or an asylum where my lack of... They asked him, "Where's your gun?" He said, "I threw it away." "How come?" "It was defective." "Well, we got to get out of here." And then he skips to this. It's not their fault. But they're trying to get me to a place, a brig or an asylum where my lack of M16 won't stick out so bad. "But listen, Cade, please listen. Don't you ever come here. Study yourself blind like Pete, lop off a toe like Papa, hightail it like Everett, go to jail, do what you have to. But don't you come here no matter what, because it'll kill you, this place. And if the Kong don't, your own heart will." And that's, he goes crazy. And it's, I'll read it on Thursday. And how his insanity is a tremendous journey into the depths of his soul. And how can he possibly be healed from that? And without giving away the ending, I won't do that. We see this family try to get themselves together. in some redemptive act to save Irwin's life. And whether they do or not, I'm not just leaving you hanging. You really don't know. So, I'm 5 minutes overdue. Tomorrow we'll start at, instead of five, we'll start at, I owe you 5 minutes, so we'll start at five.